I'm going to be running three sessions today, tomorrow, well, one a day, today, tomorrow, and Thursday, which I titled The Uses and Abuses of Economists. And there's a deliberate ambiguity in that title. That means four different things. The uses of economists in the old-fashioned sense of the word, the usages, you know, what it is that economists do. Whether they do anything useful is perhaps debatable. There's a guy who's influenced me profoundly. I sort of think of him as a teacher, though I never took a course from him. His name was Frank Knight. He said in his presidential address, he was named president of the American Economics Association at the age of 65 when he was about to retire because he wouldn't accept it earlier. One reason he wouldn't accept it earlier because he felt embarrassed about accepting it. And he explained in his presidential address that he sometimes has the feeling that when economists meet in the street, they ought to turn their faces to avoid laughing. economists have usages, and they also engage in some abuses. I had yesterday, and when I was thinking some of these things through, I had thought of listing some of the abuses in which I think economists engage, and then I realized that's nonsense. I'd be just getting into quarrels about which you probably never concerned yourself. I would prefer to allow you to take the shots. You tell me what's wrong with economists. I know that there's a good deal of dissatisfaction with economists. There's a book by a man named Robert Lekakman titled Economists at Bay. I forget the subtitle, but it's something like Why the Economists Will Never Solve Your Problems. And the book has received a great deal of attention. It's been reviewed prominently in the New York Times, and it accuses economists of just about every sin that mortal academician is capable of. And of course, you know, we've as you may have noticed, we've gone through some economic problems in recent years, and some people think that economists are supposed to solve economic problems. And since problems aren't getting solved, one wonders what the economists are doing. I can assure you that one thing they're doing is drawing very nice salaries. Recent years have been bad times for knowledge workers. You know, a knowledge worker is loosely defined as someone with an advanced degree. That's a very loose definition, but people with PhDs and even master's degrees have been finding employment opportunities not altogether satisfactory. Most deans and heads of departments and colleges and universities will tell you about the large number of letters they receive applying for jobs and the small number of jobs that they have. Well, I'm happy to report that the situation is less bad in economics than it is in any other discipline of which I'm aware. And that indicates something now about the other thing, the uses of economists by other people. Despite the fact that we've been accused of being false prophets, people are still apparently much interested in prophecy. If you don't know where you're going or how to get there, I guess it's still nice to have somebody with some academic degrees who looks like an expert in whom you can believe when you have nothing more rational to put your confidence in. Anyway, the economists continue to be hired by businesses and government and academic institutions, and that the fact that sociologists are nice people too, but businesses don't tend to want them as much as they want economists. So most of the other professions only have one or two areas bidding for their services. Also, in recent years, been for about 20, 25 years now, in order to become an economist, you have had to go through a training that includes a great deal of mathematics. Now, there's a lot of debate about the usefulness of mathematics in the training of economists, but I think all would agree on this. It is useful in keeping down the number of economists. Another thing that please the enrollments. This is rather surprising. You know, at the same time when everyone's saying, gee whiz, well, economists have mucked it up. I thought they said you couldn't have unemployment and inflation at the same time, and look what happened. Enrollments in college courses in economics have been just moving way on up. In some of the best universities, a lot of the leading universities, I mean like Harvard, Stanford, and so on, biology has long been the most important major. Well, it's all these people lusting for medical degrees. But economics has overtaken biology in some of these schools now. Why? Well, I don't know. I don't understand it. I found out at the University of Washington last month that there's a very peculiar reason for the increase in enrollments. This would, I think, only be operative in public schools. And that is the fact that the business schools, which have long been a kind of academic dumping ground, a lot of students would go into the business school because they didn't know what else to do, and besides, they didn't want to work and hard or anything. And this isn't always true, but in a lot of schools, the business school is the place where you find the poorest students, on average. But because of the increased concern about finding a job after college, a lot of students have gone flocking to the business school who otherwise might have majored in philosophy. And so the business schools are getting lots of applicants and some very bright applicants, and they have become selective. And at the University of Washington, I was told by the undergraduate advisor in economics, large numbers of students are now flocking into the economics department because they couldn't get admitted to the business school. Well, we'll take them all. Budgets are based on headcounts. I don't know, the title Uses and Abuses of Economists sort of presupposes that you're interested in what economists are doing, and really that's not true. You're not nearly as interested as I am. And I'm not going to focus on economists. I'm going to focus on economic problems. And I want you to interrupt me at any time. I think that there is such a thing as competence and expert knowledge, but I am also convinced that, I'll just confine myself to the social sciences. I don't believe that economists or any other kinds of so-called specialists in the social sciences, I don't believe that their knowledge is at all useful, is at all meaningful, unless it can be used to persuade citizens. Now, I'm not arguing for propaganda. What I'm saying is that when an economist says, well, this is a technical question, he is also saying this is irrelevant to anything you're interested in. Because if economists know something that is both true and relevant to the solution of social problems, they must translate it into language that congressmen can understand. And even beyond that, finally, they must translate it into language that informed and intelligent citizens can understand. Because we don't want to get into the position where economists or psychologists or educators, are high priests. Now, I'm quite convinced Bob would testify that congressmen do not assume that when an economist shows up to testify that he's got the answers, because for one thing they get economists who offer contradictory prophecies. but I think that there's an important point here. Unless the congressman can understand what the economist is talking about, the economist better just go back and write for his colleagues. And so I don't want to tell you anything that you accept on my authority. If you don't understand what I'm saying, if you think that I'm snowing you with something, then object. The problems that I want to sort of wander around through, I know which one I'm going to begin with this morning. It's going to be the question of unemployment and what it means. But I'm planning to wander through unemployment, inflation, and stabilization policy, the distribution of wealth and income in the United States, the whole question of power, market power, the big business question, will drift into the question of multinational corporations, and the problem of pollution. I picked these because they are all, I think, economic issues about which the public has been greatly concerned in recent years, and they're issues about which economists are supposed to have something to say, and they're issues on which economists have prominently been accused of not really saying anything worthwhile, or of speaking with forked tongues, or of speaking with such divided counsel that they're totally useless. I don't think the situation is quite that bad. Let's turn, if you will, to the question of unemployment. Do we have an unemployment problem today? Does the United States have an unemployment problem? We do.
Me and my husband.
Oh, you and your husband. Okay. All right. on that, you are an authority. But, you know, you would agree, wouldn't you, that you and your husband could have an unemployment problem, and yet that you wouldn't, the nation wouldn't have an unemployment problem. Huh?
The possibility
exists. Yeah. Okay. How do you know? Does the United States today, is there an unemployment problem? I mean, a problem that congressmen ought to be concerned about, fully employed congressmen.
We know because they tell us.
Yeah, well, how do you know that?
Every month it comes out in the newspapers and on the
TV.
All right.
Okay. There's a little number. Yeah, there's a little number that gets published. It's called the unemployment rate. The figures for June should just have been released.
Seasonally adjusted, right.
Around the 4th or 5th of the month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases something that looks, well, here's the one that they released in June 4th, 1976, the employment situation, May 1976. It's based on, well, actually there are establishment data in here too, but I don't get into that. The number that you see, 7.3%, I do not know what it has proved to be for.
It just went up 0.2% for June.
It did?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's 7.5. Seasonally adjusted. That's based on sample surveys that are taken in households, carefully selected households, and they reflect the situation during that week, which contains the 12th day of the month. What does that little number say? You know, actually, in May, the unemployment rate was 6.7%. But after they seasonally adjusted it, it went up to 7.3%. The reason a seasonal adjustment is an attempt to remove the fluctuations that you would ordinarily expect because of the month. What happens in May? Well, what happens in May, April, and even more in May, is that the warmer weather, the coming summer, is opening up employment opportunities, and it's opening them up faster than new people are coming into the labor force. Consequently, the unemployment rate goes down, the real one. But that's an illusion. You wouldn't want to say the employment situation is getting better because of that. It just means it's May. In June, the reverse is going to occur. In June, employment opportunities are still expanding, but now all kinds of people come flooding into the labor market, and the labor force expands faster than employment opportunities expand, and so the unemployment rate shoots up. But again, that doesn't reflect a worsening real situation. It means it's June. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses seasonal adjustments. In fact, you rarely see non-seasonally adjusted data. The newspapers typically won't even call attention to the fact that the data have been seasonally adjusted. Well, 7.5%, Twig says, is the current figure. Okay, is that too high? You know, how do you decide? Is 7.5% too high? What do you compare it with? What we do is we compare it with historical data. By the way, do not compare it with data in some other country, because methods of calculating labor force and employment and unemployment really differ from country to country. What you got to do is compare it with data over time. Well, you probably know that historically considered, we've been going through some of the highest unemployment, the highest unemployment rates since the Great Depression. It got up in 1975 to about 9%. And in 1958, during 1 month of the 1958 recession, it went as high as 7.2%. And the average during 1958 was 6.8%. So when it averaged 8.5% last year, that was the average throughout each month of the year, and went over 9% in 1 month, There was a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of alarm, and I'm sure some of you shared that alarm, particularly if it hits you existentially. But you've got to be careful. When you start making comparisons over time, you've got to be sure that other things haven't changed over time. And what I want to persuade you of, and I do want to do some persuading this morning, is that treating these data as objective facts is seriously misleading, and that we are going to have to do some reflections on these data that economists might help us do, but which economists are not peculiarly equipped to lead us in. Questions about the meaning and significance of work. Now, let me indicate why. Talking about the anatomy of the unemployment problem. Let me begin by saying this. I often ask my students a question, how low should the unemployment rate be? And well, they fish around, they say, well, everybody should be employed. Well, that's nonsense. We obviously don't want everybody to be employed. What about sick people, retired people, little kids? Well, they finally get around to it. They say, well, everybody who wants a job should be able to find a job. But if you think about that for just a moment, that's nonsense, because it doesn't say anything. What they really mean is that everybody who wants a job should be able to find a job he wants. See? Because the fact of the matter is, everybody can find a job. Everybody can find a job. But some of the jobs will be absolutely crummy. There's no city in the country where a person who wants a job can't find it. I know it because Colonel Sanders is always hiring. But but that's ridiculous. You don't expect a guy, 45-year-old tool and die maker, to take it with six children to take. No, I don't. But that points out the problem. Everybody, when we say everyone who wants a job should be able to find a job he wants, we're calling attention to the fact that the unemployment rate is a function of people's choices and of their expectations. And expectations have been changing very radically in recent years. There are actually two kinds of choices that enter into the determination of the unemployment rate. One is a choice to enter the labor force, and the second is a choice to accept or not accept a job opportunity when it presents itself. And because of changes in the context in which these choices are being made, I don't believe that a 7.5% unemployment rate today means anything like a 7.5% unemployment rate would have meant in 1958. We're in a different ball game, and I'll indicate later some of the reasons why. But let me quickly run through the anatomy of the measured unemployment rate to show you that that's not an objective fact in the same way in which, let's say, the size of the population is an objective fact. What the Bureau of Labor Statistics does is it begins with the population, the total population, which now is around 215 million, and then it subtracts from that all of the people who are under 16, they're automatically out, and all the people who are institutionalized, in hospitals and prisons. And what's left is called the non-institutional population. All right? If you're not in the non-institutional population, you cannot be employed or unemployed. You don't count, for the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So, for example, somebody who's in a prison and is making license plates is not employed. Someone who is 15 years old and working 40 hours a week, because he's lied about his age. he's employed, because he's lied, that's right. Yeah. But, of course, people who are working in school are not employed. There's no upper limit. When you get to be 90, you're still in the non-institutional population. But now, less than two-thirds of the people in the non-institutional population, which is currently about 155 million, less than two-thirds of these are in the labor force. And you've got to be in the labor force, as well as in the non-institutional population, in order to be unemployed. Who makes it into the labor force? Well, the following people make it into the labor force. All members of the What happened?
You've got to answer those kids. They got power.
All members of the non-institutional population who are one.
Oops. Something. Board. Doesn't work very good.
Yeah, what's the matter with this?
Used to work well, or is it?
Well, I wanted to see it. It's greasy.
Why not a piece of chalk?
Okay, this is a little better. Who are in the armed forces. Secondly, working for pay or
more than 15 hours a week, not for pay, in a family-operated business. I won't write all that out. Basically working for pay. There aren't too many of those who are working for family-operated businesses more than 15 hours a week. Three, not working because of accidents, illness, strikes, vacations. Fourth, not working but waiting to be recalled. I'll just say waiting, wait, not working but waiting. Sounds theological, doesn't it? Not working but waiting to be recalled to employment after a layoff. In other words, if you got laid off, your employer says, okay, now you just wait, we'll call you. You say, when will it be? He says, I don't know, 2 weeks, 6 weeks, I don't know, we'll call you. And so you just sit home and wait. You are counted as in the labor force. Or if you've gotten another job and you're going to take it within 30 days, then you're not working but waiting. Now, why am I stressing this? Because there's a fifth category, which is not working but actively seeking employment. And this, of course, turns out to be the bugger. Actively seeking employment. I know you can't read that, but I can't stoop that low. Now, you see, what does it mean to be actively seeking employment? Is a guy who's sitting home waiting and waiting and waiting, you know, the boss said, I will call you when we're ready. We're going to have to lay off for a while, and a month, 2 months, 3 months passes by. Is he actively seeking employment? Chances are he's not. But it doesn't matter. He's in the labor force because he's waiting to be recalled after a layoff. But what's the difference between someone who says, I need a job, if the right one comes along, and someone who says, I don't want to work unless the right job comes along? You know, what does it mean to actively seek employment? I'm please do not misunderstand. The examples that are in the back of my mind are primarily the college students, recent college graduates that I have talked to, who have a kind of ambiguous employment status. I do not want to lend any support to the notion that the unemployed are a group of lower class blacks who are shiftless. It just ain't so. There are lower class shiftless blacks. All right? If we could identify them all and put them in a corral, we would not have significantly affected the unemployment problem. That's the labor force. I should, This whole thing is the labor force. If you take this out, then you get what's left is called the civilian labor force. This group is the employed. This group is the unemployed. This group, 4 and 5, over 2, 3, 4, and 5 is the unemployment rate. All right? So 2 plus 3 over 2, 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5, seasonally adjusted, is that little number that comes out early in each month that either alarms you or causes you to think that the things are getting better. That's the unemployment rate. Now, the thing that is very disturbing and is and it is not just disturbing to non-statisticians. Jeffrey Moore was for many years the very competent head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and since his retirement, he's been doing some philosophizing about the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers, and he is now insisting that this unemployment rate is a highly misleading number that the public unfortunately treats as an objective fact and that we ought to get rid of it. We ought to learn to discount it, treat it like the entrails of birds are treated today, because he says that, I was...
4 plus 5.
Yeah, it's 4 plus 5 over. Thank you. I can't read this either. Okay, there we go. Unemployment rate is 4 plus 5 over 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5. Okay, it points out that 5, which is very, very fishy, very hard to determine in any objective way, appears in both the numerator and the denominator. And he has suggested that instead of using unemployment rates to indicate
how well the economy is doing, we should shift to employment rates. And the employment rate
is defined as 2 plus 3 over the non-institutional population. Now, the advantage of that is that those numbers are much more easily determined in an objective fashion because they don't involve difficult decisions on the part of the people who are doing the polling. In other words, you can rather easily determine who's employed, and you can easily determine who's in the non-institutional population. And if you divide the total employed by the non-institutional population, you come up with the employment rate. Now, the trouble with using the employment rate is we haven't gotten used to it. It's like shifting from Fahrenheit to centigrade. I don't know how you are, but I can't do it. I so badly want to, or kilometers, you know. I'm trying to learn to think kilometers, but I can't. I've got to translate. And when I see an employment rate, I just try it out. If some of you have run into this argument or have read something by Moore or seen employment rates, don't answer. But what would you think the current employment rate is? Or what's a good employment rate?
This is not going to be just a reciprocal of the current unemployment rate.
Is no.
93%.
No, it wouldn't be. No, no, see.
Figures, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a totally different, it's a totally different way of getting at it.
70%.
Yeah, it's about 56%. Yeah. Now, here's a significant thing. Now, this is tricky. One problem is this isn't going to be too, let's see, how can I put it? You're dealing, see, with the unemployment rate, you've got the problem in the numerator. And, of course, the unemployed, even in 1933, only 25% of the labor force was unemployed, which means 75% was employed. So when you've got the problem in the numerator, then when the problem changes, you get rather large movements. When large percentage movements. I mean, a change from when the unemployment rate goes from 5.5 to 6.5, that's a big percentage change. But when at the same time, let's say the employment rate goes from 56 to 55, it doesn't look like much, does it? But they would be the same, really the same change. However, they're not really quite the same. Now, here's a very important fact that a lot of people aren't aware of. That is that the labor force participation rate has risen so rapidly over the last decade that at the present time, even though our unemployment rate is higher than it was during any year in the 60s or 50s or 40s, our employment rate is better than it was in the early 1960s. And our employment rate is, by the standards of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, excellent. In fact, I did some little calculations, and if we got the present employment rate up to the level of 1966, and I picked 1966 because the unemployment rate in 1966 was about 3.5%. Things were booming. That was sort of when the Vietnam War and the tax cut of 64 just stimulated things, and we hadn't begun paying the inflation cost yet of that. So it was that brief good moment. But anyway, nobody claims we had an unemployment problem in 1966. All right, if we got the employment rate in 1976 up to the level at which it was in 1966. The unemployment rate would be 7.7%. Whereas in 1966, it was 3.8%. Now, what does that mean? That clearly means that people are behaving differently with respect to the labor force. Labor force participation rates are up. If you rule out the years of World War II, when clearly labor force participation rates were unusually high. I mean, during World War II, we were urging grandmothers to take jobs as riveters, and lots of people were taking jobs who really didn't want to. But if you leave those years out, the labor force participation rates, by which I mean this thing divided by the non-institutional population,
You know, in other words, what percentage of the population is looking for market employment? Now, notice I didn't say what percentage of the population is working, because I think somebody who's home taking care of children, or somebody who's up here at Holden doing work not for pay, and I think a college professor who's retired but is writing a book, I think they're all working. I even think that somebody who's out looking for a job is working. But okay, so but people want to work for pay at a much higher rate than at any other time in our history. Why? The labor force participation rate today is over 62%, meaning that over 62% of our non-institutional population wants to work in the market. Over the last decade, mainly as a result, well, entirely, in fact, as a result of population growth, there are 10% more men in the labor force. All right, there are 10% more men in the labor force in 1976 than there were in 1966. There are 33% more women. Why? Well, you can say it's because the discriminatory barriers are falling. Yes, they are. But you can lower the barriers, and the women won't enter the labor force unless they want to enter the labor force. Well, they do want to enter the labor force. Why? Why do people want to work for pay? Because they're hungry? Yeah. But how many Americans are hungry? let me give you some examples. Let's say Gloria Greer. That's a combination of Gloria Steinem and Germaine Greer. Her husband is a wealthy lawyer, makes a fantastic sum of money. And she, for many years, has been happy, she thinks, to be Mr. Greer's wife. But now she's gotten into the women's lib movement, she's had her consciousness raised, she's tired of being Mrs. Robert Greer, she wants to be her own person. And so she goes out and looks for a job. That's a way of becoming your own person. Now, I'm not criticizing women. After all, that's what we men have been doing for a long time. What about the guy who, take another woman first. Elizabeth Bennet of Pride and Prejudice she's been married to a very wealthy man. But now he loses his job, but she's not accustomed to working. And they have income because he's drawing unemployment compensation. And now his unemployment compensation runs out. And then she goes out and gets a job as a waitress. What happens to the unemployment rate as a result of that?
It didn't change.
Changes just a little bit. Because, see, she enters the labor force. She enters the labor force, which increases that denominator. Yeah, so it goes down just a little bit. All right, if she got the job. But now suppose she didn't get the job. She just looked. During the period in which she's looking, what happens to the unemployment rate? It goes up by quite a bit. Because now she's entering the denominator where she has a small effect and the numerator where she has a large effect. So one of the consequences of years like we've recently experienced with high unemployment rates is that more people enter the labor force. However, let me try another one. Inflation had its effect, too. Here's another guy, Harry, was retired at age 65, and now he's found that inflation has eaten up his savings. And so at the age of 72, he goes back to work. Now, I think that's very sad. But what happens when he starts looking for work? The unemployment rate takes a serious jump. So you see, there are all kinds of things. Or another one. What effect would you expect high incomes to have on the unemployment rate, generally? Well, I would expect unemployment rates to be higher in a society with high incomes. Why? Because the cost of being unemployed then is lower. Teenage unemployment rates, which in recent years have been hovering near 20%, that would be people between 16 and 19, because again, if you're under 16, you don't count. So teenage unemployment between 16 and 19 is very, very high, largely because the cost to a teenager
of being unemployed is usually very, very low. What is the cost? I mean, he lives with his parents. The jobs available to him aren't very good. They tend to be dead-endish. So he's not embarked on a career. So if he quits, he's not giving anything up. He can get another one like this. And Martin Feldstein of Harvard has suggested that those people who berate teenagers for such weak attachment to the labor force, what's the matter with youth today? They won't work. There are jobs available. Teenagers would just rather run around on their motorcycles. And by the way, it's interesting. I'd like to see a survey on how many unemployed teenagers have motorcycles. I suspect a lot of them do. Which indicates that the financial pinch isn't too severe. And also, by the way, may indicate why they prefer to be unemployed. If you have a motorcycle, the cost of being employed is high. You can't ride around all day on your motorcycle. Not on all that, I lost the point of what I was going to say. Oh, Martin Feldstein suggested that before we condemn these teenagers, you know, who won't hold jobs, we should consider the possibility that they may be doing what we've long thought it was okay for college students to do, just goof around for about 4 years. I think that the people who leave school after high school are aware of the fact that college isn't all a matter of life is real, life is earnest, that there is some beer drinking and general sporting about. I think that college is at least a moratorium. It's a period of waiting, you know, where you live in a sheltered environment while you wait and grow older. And we're a wealthy society. We can afford that. But it does funny things to unemployment rates. And the unemployment rate is climbing among 20 to 24-year-olds now as they begin to do what high school students have been doing for a long time, which is leave school and just remain loosely attached to the labor force, drifting in, drifting out. But as long as they give the impression of looking for employment in some active way, they are going to be counted in the unemployed, and hence they're going to inflate those unemployment numbers. Well, I gotta quit by, let me pose some questions here.
I wanted to make a point that followed.
Yeah.
That according to statistics I've been reading, much of the increase in the labor force due to the fact that families with fairly low income, and I'm talking about the 8,000 to 15,000, have two wages, that the force of inflation or the force of some style of life, desire, those are not high salaries or high income for families.
They're not?
Say 8 to 15 is not high.
Relative to what?
Well, relative to a family of 4 or 10,000. Think of income.
Well, but still, Al, would you say that $8,000 a year for a family of 4 is a low income? It is certainly low relative to.
It's not a high income.
Yeah.
You really have to live very, very close if you don't have at least $10,000.
Yeah. Okay. Al, the latest figures. These are pretty hot off the presses. The Bureau of Labor Statistics compiles budgets for families in order to give us some notion of give us some benchmarks. They calculate a lower budget, an intermediate budget, and a higher budget. And they're sometimes called an austerity budget. It's a budget for a family of 4 that would enable them to, they can get along. They're not going to be on welfare or anything like that. They can make it, but, there's no room for luxuries. And then there's a moderate luxury budget. That's the intermediate one, where you can, go out when you want to occasionally. And then there's the luxury budget. Now, those budgets currently are the luxury budget is $22,294. The intermediate budget or moderate luxury budget is $15,318. Again, these are family incomes for families of 4 in their urban areas, by the way. And the lower budget, the so-called austerity budget, which is, it's $9,588. Now, those are meaningful in terms of, the way average Americans behave. I mean, if you use those as some kind of indicators of wealth or poverty, you're definitely dealing with relative measures of wealth or poverty. Because if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data on poverty levels, they're much lower.
That's those figures are what I would expect them to be in terms of my generalization from 8 to 15, not a high income for poor people.
But Al, it's not because of our expectations.
I agree. All I'm saying is that in the 12 to 15, the figures I see are 75% with two incomes. 75% of those returning incomes taxes would be have two incomes.
Yeah.
And something about the pressure to get those two incomes. And I was setting that over against women who suddenly decide they want to work because their husbands have got high incomes. These are not high income, which they are. I would say they're kind of incomes that people work because they want to have some of the things, and you don't have very much at 15,000. Certainly, don't have very much at 10,000.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah. If I gave the impression with that example of Gloria Greer that you know women who work are all married to lawyers who earn 100,000. Right. I didn't no. What I was trying with that weird example was to indicate that people go into the labor force for reasons having some people go into the labor force for reasons having nothing to do with income.
I'm trying to indicate that a great percentage of the women who are the second incomes are in families where the second incomes are meaningful just in terms of bread and butter.
Right, right. In fact, when you get up to the it would be interesting if we went around here and practiced true confessions. I suspect this is very definitely an upper middle income group. Very few people come to Holden who aren't upper middle income. And we just confess on how much we find we need to get along. I can remember in 1957 when I started teaching, I was teaching an extension class with an accountant. And he asked me a question. He said he always asks guys who just got out of college, went to work for his accounting firm. He said, what salary would you like to be making in 10 years? And I was currently making, in 57, $4,800. And I said, 10 years, I'd like to be making about $6,000. That's of course, that assumes no inflation. Now, let's see, the price level is about, it hasn't quite doubled, but it's pretty close. So let's make that $12,000. I said, and I really thought it. I really believed it. But some funny thing happened. I found that as I got more income, I'm ashamed of the income I've been making in recent years, and I wonder where it went, and I'm disturbed about its tendency to trap me. I'm not I don't want to play soul true confessions here, I think one of the binds we're in, I think Al agrees, is that expectations are very, very high in our society. Of course, this family where the guy works in a factory and the woman works in a restaurant, of course, they're high there too. And why are they high? Who's taught them this? Who's taught these people that life cannot be meaningful and they cannot hold up their heads with pride unless they're making at least $15,000 a year? Most of the world, I thought the coffee break was at 10:30 today.
Isn't it 10:30?
No, it's not. It's 10:15.
Keep going.
I think this is a fact, a problem we're going to have to face. The unrealistically high expectations today. Among a lot of people graduating from college, as you probably know, expectations are simply absurdly high. They are looking for jobs that will offer income and prestige and meaningful work and status in a combination that just isn't available in anything like those quantities. And that's going to create a very, very serious social problem. These people are going to be fairly well educated, fairly articulate, and quite alienated. And
Paul, there's one thing. I want to take a relation with you a little bit on the fact you said these salaries from 10 to 15,000 and they have to have two in the family working in order, you don't have bread and butter, and I'm sure you're using that word loosely. I think back, and you didn't get back this far because you probably weren't affected directly by it, but back into the 30s when we had a real depression and when people, they're out, when you said unemployment, I'm unemployed,
that meant that if somebody didn't come around the next day and give you a handout of food you maybe didn't eat that day. It was that bad. And I can remember it because I was a teenager then. And that was really a catastrophe. In other words, 1% then of unemployment was a catastrophe. We're 7% today with our social programs we have is not a catastrophe. It's just an inconvenience. But what I was thinking about, going back to this point of bread and butter, when I go back to my dad, for instance, when he got married, the big deal for him, it turned out that somebody broke into his rooming house and they stole all his clothes. So his big deal was that he had to wait long enough to get some clothes. I mean, he had earned money to get enough clothes he wanted before he got married. That was the big deal. Now, when I got married, my big deal was I had a car, and I had the other things, you know, clothes and so forth. But my big deal was I had to wait a little while to buy a house. True, I had to pay for it a little down here and pay it over a period of 50 years or something, whatever the original thing was. And I was paying like $4,500 for it, so man, that was a fortune at that time. Okay, my kids come along, I've got two daughters, and they get married. And so what do? They got to have two cars to begin with. I mean, not that they have to, but that's the society. And they got to buy a house before they get married. And it turns out that in one case, one of my son-in-law was employed, so there was no problem there. Although my daughter was still going to college, so I got out of paying for that because he paid for the college, see, on that. But that was their standard of life. My other daughter gets married, and her husband is still going to college and goes to college for 3 years because he's got to have a master's in order to teach retarded. Okay, what I'm saying is that our concept of bread and butter has changed over the years. And we got to be real careful when we talk about bread and butter that we aren't talking about the television in the house, good furniture, two cars in the garage, and that type of thing. So really, I think when you go back, I'd go back beyond 58 if I was you and talk about a case where you're talking about survival, which was the 30s, and then work up from there.
Okay, well, I certainly agree that I thought one of the things drifting through almost everything I was saying was that unemployment, when somebody becomes unemployed today, it's most unlikely that he's in the kind of severe bind that he was in the 1930s. In fact, there are people, and I don't multiply cases, but there are people who would say there are multiple earners in the family. Maybe man's employed in a job that's covered by unemployment compensation and his wife is working, and when he gets unemployed and he starts drawing 55% or so of his income as unemployment compensation, which is not subject to either Social Security tax or personal income tax, and he also doesn't have to pay the cost of commuting to work, he may actually very easily be getting a higher monetary income than he was getting while he was working. Well, clearly he has no strong incentive to go back to work until his unemployment compensation is expired. So, what I want to say is we got a problem here, but what I'm trying to suggest is it's not a problem that economists are equipped to solve. And when people, there are a lot of people who are saying today, when are the economists going to get the unemployment rate down to 3%? Some candidates for the presidency have been talking about programs to get the unemployment rate down to 3% involving all sorts of techniques of fiscal and monetary manipulation, which is one thing I want to get in tomorrow, whether do we really know how to do that anyway. But what I keep thinking of, given the meaning of work today, I mean, given our attitudes toward income, I wonder, what is the meaning of income for us? What is the meaning of work? Why do people work? Why do people not work? How is this all shifting? Are we, as Bridget Berger has suggested, going to experience this real crisis of a shortage of meaningful work opportunities so that the government ought to get into the business of creating people-oriented jobs? Bridget Berger has suggested that we're going to have a revolution unless we find meaningful jobs for all of these college graduates. And that means there's going to have to be a vast expansion of government-financed people services, psychiatric counselors in neighborhoods. What are the dangers associated with that? but what are the alternatives? And what I keep thinking of is Charles Lamb's old story about the roast pig, which I heard somebody cite. You used that. Yeah. You know that story, you know, about how did they learn to barbecue meat? You know, the kid was home. They used to keep the pigs down underneath the straw house, and keep for warmth, I guess. And one day when Daddy was out in the fields, Junior lit him, drug some sticks together, started a match, burned the place down, killed all the pigs. He was horrified. He touched one to see whether it was still alive, burned his finger, stuck it in his mouth. You know, and so what happens, Dad comes home about to beat him, but touches the pig, so they sit there and eat. And so what they do is they build themselves another house, drive the pigs underneath, burn the house down. You know, and when we're trying to get the unemployment rate down to 3% or 4% or 5% through the techniques that economists know something about, I'm convinced we're playing the roast pig game. We're off on the wrong track altogether. It's a kind of neurosis. I think that we are unwilling to face the questions of meaning and value and the way we interrelate and what work means for us and what income means. Questions of how we behave toward one another with our income and in the process down at work of getting that income. We can't face those problems. We don't know where to begin. They're too tough. So we'd rather just institute a little fiscal and monetary policy.
I have one question that's hitting me because of next year on our emphasis on everybody gets sabbaticals and so on just what you've been saying. Because like when we took off for 18 months in Europe and everybody asked, well, how can you afford it? And I said, how much you spend on cars in your ministry? Well, I spent $2,800 in mine. You spend on furniture in your life. I spent $700 in mine. But that's the way. Well, I didn't buy a car. I was 35. And I had the wealthiest parish in ELC. And they were just uptight because they said they're faster running around on a bike, which I borrowed from the fellow who owns Mirror Lumen. So I put out money for that. But, you see, I had money to take 18 months off in my 40s, which I insisted we were going to do as a family, because that would make up to the rest of the family for the fact that I'd had to be a preacher during all those earlier years. And really, it was the greatest thing that ever happened. And now next year we're going to say God intends everybody, not just professors, but that he does. I mean, the directive is everybody gets a sabbatical. But how can you do it if your intention is you're going to live on $15,000 a year, come hell or high water? I don't know. And that bothers me when you say that we got upper middle class people, because I'm quite aware we do too. We wouldn't have any money in the bank to run the place. But, I want people to live on less so they can have more time for more fun.
My husband did an interesting little study. I'm really harassing you when I say we're unemployed. My husband doesn't have a job. I'm going to school next year. We were horrified when he did our income tax this year because we made $19,000 last year. And it wasn't all out of withholding, so it chopped us in April. But we aren't worried at all about finding a job. And it doesn't matter how much money we get because we've been socking money away so I can go to school. And it's no real problem. We live on very little. But he was asking some of the men of our church, and it's a fairly wealthy parish that we live in, if they would prefer to have more than the 2 weeks off out of their very high compression jobs, because they're executives and scientists. Would you rather have more time or an increase in salary? And very few wanted more time. Mm-hmm. Almost all would have chosen to have more salary. Like you said, 90%, I don't know. That's just the bulk of it.
That's sad. That's really sad.
See, that's just the opposite side from Norway. Yeah. Just the opposite side from Norway and what they just did. Whether they got their policies and uproar and Labour Party and everybody else. Everyone wants less money and more time. What are you going to do with this one? You know.
They got a tax structure to encourage that, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, we really haven't come to grips with the reality that our standard of living is too high. Mm-hmm. And none of us are willing to start chopping it down yet. And I think that is one of the hard realities that people have really not come to grips with yet and tried to do away with this two-car, three-car concept of starting out a family with. Don't you think that's a real problem?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Well, listen, the more our choices are bad, isn't really, when you talk about standard, you're talking about our choices are bad. And this thing Carol was pointing out, what's important to you? In other words, is it that two cars in the garage, or get rid of one of those cars and take an extended vacation where you learn something or enjoy certain other things? This, to me, is the important thing. In other words, you accomplish at least. Now, I was employed for 35 years in an industry that was where I highly concentrated on it. And I've been unemployed for the last 6 years, retired from. And it's a tremendous enjoyment, but I haven't done anything, it hasn't been as concentrated, but I've had a lot more fun in the last 6 years than I've had in the 30 years. I think it's as much fun. But I think, and I got a certain standard of living. But I have to make choices all the time on how I use my time and what I, and the kind of things. I don't change my standard. I just use that, I appropriate that, my funds in a different way. And one of the things now is the fun of coming up here, because it's a reasonable, I can do it in a certain way that becomes reasonable for me to do it. It's just a terrific thing to do. Now, I could afford, on that, my income, I could afford to take, say, 6 weeks in Europe. But that wouldn't appeal to me at all. My appeal is to come to something like this, or to go to a university and take a course or do something like that, which doesn't cost me very much, really.
It's probably wiser to not tell people from the pulpit or the lectern that they got to reduce their standard of living. They like most preaching, it doesn't make any difference. But that's true. There's a difference between bearing witness and preaching. But it rouses in people's minds the wrong picture. I think what we have to do is begin searching for ways to have as much or more fun, less stupidly. I think almost everyone will admit this. Everyone I encounter admits it, that we are placed by our social circumstances into situations where we don't have the kinds of choices we wish we had, but we don't know how to alter the social circumstances to be able to make the choices we want to make. A classic example is the automobile. Lots of people wish they could get rid of the thing, but they're caught in a social situation where, as long as other people hang on to their automobiles, the city and its transportation system is going to be structured in such a way that for them to get rid of their automobile would reduce their standard of living fantastically, more than they're willing to accept. I'm sure there are people in Los Angeles who wish the automobile would blow away, probably seven or eight. But the cost of getting rid of your automobile if you live in Los Angeles is fantastic.
College education for your kids is probably equally important or big or demanding.
Yes, but that would be the wrong place to cut.
Well, the place on that gets to be 10-1, which my college has.
Education, you get rid of the expense.
Getting rid of the expense.
Hey, it's 10:30, and it really ain't fair to deprive all of you people of your coffee break.